go so long and then edit out the beginning.
Sorry?
I'm going to let it record so long and I'll edit out the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, fine.
Thank you.
Okay.
You had it here yesterday. Is there a little bit of water around?
Yeah, that's fine.
Have led me to
discuss with you mobile phones as advertised. They're very important and critical. And then after doing a little extra push through mobile phones, I'm going to try to spend the last part of our time together today to talk about conflict in Africa, the wars of Africa. This is, again, a big subject, so we're going to talk about two subjects by popular demand rather than one. I hope that's okay. And in between, I'm going to try to pause for a minute or two and take one or two questions, and then we'll go and switch subject matters. They are related, but not intimately related. But they are related, and I'll try to point out why. Now, this is a good slide which discusses what we talked about yesterday. And this slide really talks about the African mobile phone connections. We're somewhere here, and they have it out to the population in 2015. What this means, what this slide shows, and what all the extrapolations show, is that 80% of all Africans have mobile phones today. Now, everyone here in this room is carrying a mobile phone. You may switch it off if you like. I'm carrying two, an American one and a South African one. I'll bet there's several people here who have more than one in their pockets. No politician that I've met in the rest of Africa, plus South Africa, is without two or three mobile phones at all times with different cards, different secret combinations, and so on. So the important thing is that this new technology, look at the slope of this line. Look at 2008 to the present. The line is going up in an extraordinary slope. The mobile phone has already revolutionized the way Africa does business. It revolutionizes, I hope you all realize this, and push back if you think this is wrong, but it has revolutionized the way in which stakeholders, citizens, relate to their governments in profound ways. You live in a municipality where supposedly an SNS message on a mobile phone will get a reaction from the municipal government, from the city hall, instantly, within 24 hours. And you'll get someone asking at lunch to speak to the mayor about potholes on her street. The mayor assured me that there was a mechanism for getting a response. I don't know if that's true or not. But it's the SNS capability of the mobile phone. And young people, there are quite a few here, young people don't talk on phones anymore, they text on phones. And people in Africa, north of South Africa, but also South Africa, use their mobile phones almost exclusively in the text mode. It's cheaper. No one talks on the phones. But the text messages and the ability to use photographs and videos through the text system has revolutionized the way in which the peoples of Africa are grasping the technological revolution, dealing with their governments, building their economies, and transforming the way in which rural farmers and urban persons cope with the vicissitudes of Africa. And so if Africa is going to catch up with the rest of the world, if Africa is going to better the lives of its people, if Africa's going to be better governed, more transparent, and more competently led, the mobile telephone, this little device, is going to play a major role in ensuring that Africa does emerge as a leading force in the new world order. Now that may seem an extraordinary set of goals for a little handheld computer, usually the size of a few fingers. But that's what's happening in Africa, and Africa has leapt across a lot of technological barriers. And other countries in Africa are well ahead of South Africa in the way they use the devices. Kenyans are well ahead of Americans, Europeans, and so on in the way they have adapted to the devices. And there are some things I'll talk about in a moment that Ghanaians are doing, everyone else is doing. The people in Niger, a very poor country, are also doing special things in Niger that are not done elsewhere in the world. So that the widespread availability of mobile phones gives new power, and the power is important, to people whose horizons have hitherto been very limited by circumstance, isolation, education, and so on. And all the studies show that mobile phone technology does what we have wanted to do for a long time, which is to increase productivity. Connectivity is productivity. And mobile telephone technology has done something which nothing else could have done, which is lower the transaction costs of doing business. The opportunity costs are now very, very inexpensive in a way that's critical. So the mobile phone, in my grand way of thinking about it, has unlocked human potential in ways that nothing else that I can think of has done. The internet doesn't do this, but the mobile phone does, particularly the texting capability. And I'll try to give you some examples. There are many. So what this shows is that 2/3 to 3/4 and soon 90% of all Africans have mobile phones. Now, we can't tell the precise numbers because these are not physical devices so much as SIM cards. And some people are carrying 2 or 3 SIM cards, so there's some duplication, but the numbers are still enormous considering the poverty of Africa. Wealthier countries show higher penetrations, but even very poor countries show usage rates of at least 30%. This is the connections by country. In 2011, which is somewhat out of date already, and you could just look and see that these are the truly connected countries, and the whiter ones are less so. Even by the end of 2013, when I last checked, even some of the most remote villages in the most remote parts of Africa enjoyed mobile telephone coverage, and only a handful of countries, Guinea-Bissau, Ethiopia, Mali, and Somalia, remained relatively less connected than the majority of Africa. But another curious thing in this not too well connected country, Somalia, a country that isn't a country at the moment for the most part, mobile phone rates are about a quarter of what they are in this country. They run through Dubai. People in Dubai have set up the towers, and Somalis in war-torn Mogadishu talk very long and text long for very, very, very little. The only constraint in this mobile phone surge across the continent has been the fact that base towers have had to be put up in all kinds of strange places in Africa. But it's not the putting up of the base towers, it's powering the base towers. So the only constraint on mobile phone penetration of Africa is the cost of diesel fuel. Nigeria spends $430 million a minute fueling all its cell phone towers throughout its country per minute. And that's the impediment. Obviously, solar would be better, but solar isn't reliable everywhere in Africa. Not everywhere is using solar to power the posts. But even in the war-torn Congo, mobile phone accessibility and penetration of signal is pretty good, even when the wars are going on, for two reasons. One, the guerrillas depend on the communication, and two, commerce in even a war-torn place like the Congo depends on it. Now, the striking thing, let's see if we can go up a bit, I'll go back a bit. Let's take a look at this, and then I'll go to the next one. This until 2013, the internet, which I won't talk about too much, was hindered by the lack of overseas connections. Now this blue line, very important, has connected Zimbabwe, Kenya, and so on to the rest of the world. The South African undersea cable has been important, but the orange one is also critical. Now, let's see where we're going. Yes, okay. Take a look at that while I try to explain the many ways in which Kenya is ahead of the entire world. 10% of the GDP of Kenya moves through mobile banking. The M-Pesa system in Kenya is a banking system far ahead of any other place in the world, so that people can actually do all their banking off their mobile phones in a secure way. They can shift money throughout Kenya, throughout East Africa, and across the world. They can receive remittances from Britain, from the US, they can send money, they can donate to charity when there was need for help in after the Somali famine. Kenyans donated by a few clicks on their mobile phones. M-Kesho in Kenya enables you to put money into an interest-bearing account in a banking system that's completely secure, and to find out the interest rates off your mobile phone and to check your bank accounts on a regular basis and so on. And in Kenya and Tanzania, these money platforms are much more reliable than Western Union. So what has happened in the last, literally in 3 years, 4 years, where someone in Kenya might have asked the bus driver going to a village to take some cash to a relative, that's all finished. The transmission of money is almost entirely through the mobile banking system, and it is suspected that in 2-3 years banks won't have bank accounts where you can walk and see them. You'll do it all through your mobile phone. Now, other countries are catching on in Africa and in Asia, and in Europe and in the US will be very slow, unfortunately, to follow up. There is some follow up. In Zambia, where only 20% of Zambians have bank accounts at the moment, something called the Mobile Transaction International processes 1.5 million worth of payments and microloans each year and disperses World Food Program charity aid through mobile phones. Something called Currency Fair facilitates the shift of foreign currency across borders. So no longer at the airport do you pick up your currency, you get it on your mobile phone, and you spend it on your mobile phone. And this is all clever and technologically interesting, but it's empowering people who had no power before. And that's among its importance. There's a whole other area. Farmers, first in West Africa, now in East Africa, now throughout most of Africa, north of South Africa, maybe in South Africa too. Farmers who want to take their cheaper goats to market, who want to take their yams to market, who want to find out what the price of cassava is in the local market, so they know whether to go to that market or this market to sell their produce, or whether they need to wait a day or two or a week or two. They can find out the prices instantly through text messages. They press a couple buttons, they have the price of whatever product they need in the markets of Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, Niger, and so on. That's almost universal in large parts of Africa. Something called TradeNet in Ghana is like eBay. It matches buyers and sellers of agricultural commodities. So people can get the best prices, can search around for the best prices. This has changed the way in which those farmers that I said yesterday are disappearing. It changes the way in which the stronger ones are doing business. It also empowers people who had no economic power before and had to sell to middlemen or had to sell to marketing boards and so on. There's something called ZAM-MARS in Wolof. It means know your market. It's another mobile phone site. It gives farmers real-time text messages that provide abundant information about the prices of almost anything, so people know what to sell and buy in markets. In Niger, Ghana, Senegal, you can type in a coded text message and receive the prices that poultry or goats or sheep are fetching in 10 markets, and you can choose which market to go to. This isn't helping my favorite distressed group, which is the chicken sellers in Lusaka market. I'm going to talk about them tomorrow, and I want to mention them to you now because they're being outmaneuvered by the Chinese chicken sellers. And so they haven't quite caught on how to deal with market prices at 6 a.m. in the morning, but the Chinese are teaching them a trick or two. Now, 8,000, there's another way that the mobile phone is being used to improve Africa. 8,000 cocoa farmers in Ghana receive daily practical advice on cultivation practices, crop diseases, post-harvest care, et cetera, farm safety, child labor rights, and health issues through their telephones from the World Cocoa Foundation's site, which is called Cocoa Link. So if you're a cocoa farmer, you can get everything you once got from a extension agent, what we call in the States, the farm advice agents in many, many places in Africa. That's now available. It wasn't available in 1980, it wasn't available in the 90s, wasn't available until 2 or 3 years ago. Now it's available and it's free. So farmers are able to take advantage. Now, the other way you can use as a relatively poor African from a village, even from a small urban center, you can, instead of going to the classified advertisements in a newspaper, you click on a site and you find out what the job opportunities are at that moment. In Nairobi, in Kisumu, in Iringa, and so on. So you could minimize your travel time, maximize your opportunity cost, and do all these things that were once extremely difficult. Previously, you had to rely on rumors, you had to catch a radio talk, maybe, or you had to rely on something that was third hand or fourth hand or fifth hand. Now you can get an instant response, and so Africans, even partially literate Africans, are able to do this and maximize their economic and their social benefits. A mobile layaway scheme in Kenya allows women to save little by little for water pumps by sending micropayments to an NGO working to empower women. And they send the micropayments by a couple of clicks. And eventually they get their water pumps and they don't have to trek several kilometers to collect water. As I said yesterday, to send their daughters to collect water. Study, by the way, I thought of mentioning it yesterday, I mentioned it now, a study in Uganda recently showed that 50% of all girls drop out of primary school in Uganda because they had to fetch water. And there's a crisis in the family economics, and they had to do something about it. So there are reasons when asked, or I dropped out because something happened, I had to go fetch the water, or I had to go to work in the fields. Now, mobile phones also report medical worries, human medical worries and pastoral worries. Swine flu epidemics can be stopped much more easily nowadays. Rinderpest, locust worries and so on can be tracked, and we can have better information on a real-time basis. In South Africa, in large parts of Africa, people who need to be reminded to take their tuberculosis medicines are getting text reminders every morning in an automated way. And this is helping. You all know that South Africa has the most virulent antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis in the world. It's a leading killer in South Africa, particularly in KwaZulu. And this text messaging has already reduced the reinfections by 10% or so. And the hope is over several years, this is going to do a major job for mobile phone. In the right hands, mobile phones are also diagnostic tools. There's a way of identifying malaria by sending a photograph from a remote site to a medical center, so that instead of the remote clinic relying on reports weeks later about malaria, they can get the malaria responses right away, within 10 minutes or so. But the really exciting thing, and this is just a tip of change, pediatricians have strapped tiny little magnifying otoscopes to mobile phones and have done something which straps them to the mobile phone, and they can ask a nurse in a clinic to put the otoscope in a baby's ear, and they can get an image and get a diagnosis right away. The doctor, of course, is in Accra, the patient is in northern Ghana. This is happening, and this is expanding to all kinds of things. Schistosomiasis is now being quickly analyzed in that way, and I don't even begin to keep up with these enormous technological shifts which are going to improve people's health. We do know that mothers in Ghana and maybe in a few other countries receive lactation advice. As soon as they give birth, via text messages, and they get enforcement, encouragement, and so on. And apparently it's proving a great success in Ghana and in nearby countries. But the I'm excited as a political person, particularly by the possibility of using this tiny little handheld computer to begin to change the way in which officialdom oppresses people in many countries. Here's what you could do, it's fairly obvious, what you could do with a mobile phone with a text capacity when someone asks you for a bribe, you can click and you could send a message to a central bribe incident bureau, and at least we have evidence that so many bribes are taking place. We can't stop the bribes at that point, but we can use this to build up evidence. And if the text message can be a little bit broader, one can say where, when, and maybe, if one is brave enough, whom. So they're using this in Nigeria. Whenever a bus is stopped by a traffic policeman for an imagined headlight problem or something, and a bribe is asked for, the driver simply reaches for his mobile phone and clicks, and the police officer walks away. So that's working. This will take a generation to have an impact, but at least we know that we can do some serious reporting. There was a case I wrote about in some place in KwaZulu where municipal officials actually responded much more rapidly when they saw a photograph transmitted by text about sewage piling into somebody's house. And once they saw the photograph, they realized they couldn't evade the issue, and they came and fixed it within a day. This man had tried for months to get action, and he had to use the visual proof and show it, and they knew they were cornered. And so it did something to help them. The other thing is, and I noticed, I was down in City Hall today, and I noticed that they're already way in which there's a rapid response to bureaucratic needs, but one can cut out the bureaucratic barriers that sometimes cause corruption by enabling people to procure licenses by a mobile phone. That's happening in Kenya. You can ask for your license, send your details, get your license back on your mobile phone and show it. Licenses, permits, birth certificates, et cetera, so there's no longer the need to queue outside the bureaucratic grill and wait until the bureaucrat decides to look at you and wait another while he, she decides what to do, and the whole possibility of money passing disappears because the mobile phone cuts it out. So that's been very important. Now, Africa has a number of weak states, and violence against persons is the scourge of weak states. And we've always had anecdotal reports, but now the ubiquity of mobile telephones makes it possible to document by text message instances of state-sponsored predation, domestic assault, rapes, and other violence against women. Text messaging alerts can trigger police prevention, if they'll come. It can provide accurate statistics, which are useful in accumulating evidence. It might, in some countries, provide a stimulus to parliamentary action. And at the very least, it can provide warnings to other peoples in the same area. One of the hopes is that we can use this in the Eastern Congo so people can be alerted when gangs are marauding in the Eastern Congo. We can also learn where the hotspots are and maybe send reinforcements. The UN is using drones in the Eastern Congo. This is going to help the drones to know where to go, to where to sight and look after the predators. Now, this kind of detection is being pursued more and more. It depends a lot on the better governments implementing these changes first, forcing them on the less willing governments, and eventually having a surveillance system which is stakeholder operated. Not surveillance through the internet and copying your internets and so on, your internet messages, but by actually coping with text messages. Now, there's one area where this has been enormously successful. It has some problems, but elections are freer because of the mobile telephone. In Ghana, in Senegal, in the last terrible Zimbabwe election, which was fixed beforehand rather than during, the mobile phone, the text messaging capability, people were able to report on the number of people voting at voting stations. They were able to report on the immediate result at a polling station, so they cut out the possibility that results could be altered after they left the polling station. And those results were photographed and uploaded to a secure computer in another country, so it couldn't be tampered with. In Senegal, the upload of the 2008 Senegalese election was uploaded to Paris and therefore couldn't be tampered with, and therefore the government couldn't really manipulate the results. In Ghana, what was very useful was to know what was going on very early in the voting day and what the quick poll results were showing, and then rumors which might have led to riots were dispelled by people saying, no, that's not happening. This isn't happening. We have evidence from a poll, a large poll of the cell phones, of the mobile phones. So if the leaders of Africa want, as I hope they will, to strengthen human outcomes in Africa, this is the mobile telephone is a critical tool which will help Africans gain control over their universes, which will enable the best leaders to, instead of doing vague focus groups, to know what is actually wanted by the people, and it'll enable civil society, which is only now beginning to have a role in much of Africa, to have evidence on which to put governments' feet to the fire. So the mobile phone permits this enormous change in the empowerment of ordinary citizens. The critical element, again, is the is to level the playing fields between citizen and government. And the mobile phone has shown the ability to do that. And believe me, I've just scratched the surface of what the mobile phone is doing in Africa. Asians are copying some of the African innovations. Eventually, those innovations will reach the Northern Hemisphere as well. But this is where the South is well ahead. Particularly pioneered by Kenya, Tanzania, now spreading all kinds of places, with almost every country having a particular innovation. I wanted to mention, forgive me for coming back to it now, I wanted to mention that Literacy is taught also by the mobile phone. In Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world, the mobile phone is used to teach illiterates the letters and what those letters mean. And the tests of reading, teaching reading through the mobile phone, and is apparently, according to research, worked extremely well. So it's a tool which can be used. This is not the best tool in the world necessarily, but something which has universal application through to Africa and later to the world. Now, let me pause here, if I may. I have one or two questions and then go on to this other subject.
One observation and one question. The question is, your disastrous talk of yesterday could be changed because of this, when there is more family planning information on the phone.
There's an important point here, though, that Africans are not strangers to family planning, but their economic self-interest often prevents taking the steps that we might call family planning. Your question.
Yeah, the question is a short one. The budget, the majority of the population is less than $1 a day. Airtime or talk time, that's the usual term for it, is expensive.
No.
The big companies earn a lot of money. So I wonder how, and often when I'm in Zambia, people ask, please give me some airtime. So I wonder how their budget is.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The question is, what about the costs of all this? First of all, as I indicated, people are not talking on their telephones. They're using their handheld computers to send a message. Messaging is pretty cheap, cheaper than talking. And the other brilliant thing that Mo Ibrahim introduced, and which is now standard, so Mo Ibrahim made his millions by realizing that he had to escape billing. So the SIM card wasn't invented by him, but the insistence on a SIM card was the critical element of people buying time, so that there was never any need to bill. It's still a problem in South Africa. Electricity rates, water rates, collecting on them from people with little money. The SIM card has cut out the arbitraging and has made it pay as you go, and it works. Now, the crucial element, most of Africa, my impression is, the text messaging is much cheaper than South Africa.
Okay.
Somalia, very cheap. Lots of places, very cheap. It's certainly worth it if you can get prices in the market, if you can get a free incoming text with lactation advice. If you can get your tuberculosis reminder free, because the incoming texts are always less expensive than the outgoing. So there's a lot of it that is working relatively inexpensively. And only a few countries in Africa insist on registering SIM cards. Zimbabwe has a very clever device. It doesn't work. You have to give your name and address, rank and serial number, mother's maiden name, social security number, everything else, to the authorities if you want to buy a SIM card. Now, of course, they've accumulated all this data, which they can't use, because no one can keep account of who's calling the SIM cards. Another question? Okay, one more, and then this question, then I'll go on. Yeah.
Thank you. I'd just like to know who owns the mobile companies, who's providing the mobile phones? Are they foreigners, are they Chinese, or are they Africans?
You're not saying the handsets.
The handsets and the network system.
The handsets are all the obvious Chinese and Korean and Finnish providers. I mean, the obvious ones, US too. But the big provider, Nokia, is still the biggest in Africa. the BlackBerry is going, is phasing out. We could do a poll if we had time of everyone here. You could hold up your phones, we could see who made them. But that's not important. I don't think that's the important question is who owns the cell phone carriers. And of course, South Africans own the South African carriers and also the huge market, which is Nigeria. That's largely South African controlled and owned. The other big company is Kuwait. Kuwait owns Cell Africa, Celtel, I think it's called, which is most East Africa. There's some French companies in Francophone West Africa, but it's not American and not Chinese and indigenous plus these ones I mentioned. Okay, let me shift gears, spend a few minutes anyway before leaving some time for a few questions. Yesterday's map. I don't think yesterday's map is here. Okay. I'll maybe be able to point out even on this poor map. How many people would you think have died in the wars of Africa since 1990? Anyone like to hazard a guess?
10 million.
10?
10 million.
Sorry?
10 million. 10 million.
Okay, tens of millions and 10 million. Anyone else?
No, 10 million.
The figure is about 15 million. It's a colossal number. The conflict in Northern Ireland went on for 30 or 40 years, 3,500 people were killed. Mau Mau killed 32 whites in Kenya, 32. 10,000 Kenyans and so on. But just think of 2 million Angolans, 3 million Sudanese, 3 million Congo and Congolese and counting, and 800,000, a million Rwandans and counting, and so on and so on. These are real numbers, and most of these people killed were civilians, collateral damage. Now the wars are still going on, but the good news is that there are many fewer people being killed these days than there were in the 1990s. The wars of Africa have slowed down, they haven't stopped. The number of conflicts is much fewer than it was in the 90s and the early parts of the 21st century. So we're making some progress, but war is still going on. Somalia has been at war, internal war. I'm talking obviously about civil war. Somalia has been engulfed in civil war since 1993. There's no end in sight of the wars in Somalia. Somalia is the seat of inter-clan, cross-clan rivalries, warlords, stateless, non-state actors, and so on. It's also the home of Al-Shabaab, which means the youth, and which is the inheritors of the Islamic civil courts, then the Islamic civil union, now Al-Shabaab, an Al-Qaeda supported, affiliated terrorist organization that blew up the Westgate shopping mall, as you know, in Kenya in September, and is still a potent force within, see if this helps at all, within Somalia. And has support from Al-Qaeda in the Yemen and gets a lot of its funding and supplies from the Yemen up here, but doesn't control any big towns any longer. The Somali federal government controls Mogadishu, controls Kismayo with Kenyan military help, and the war continues. The Ethiopians have been in and out of Somalia several times to knock heads and keep order. They have the strongest military in the region. But Somalia is now held together, to the extent it's held together, by Ugandan troops, Burundian troops, a few Botswana troops, and Ethiopians on the... I'm sorry, the good map is...
The red map was the...
Okay. See, this is... The border there is Ethiopia, and that's been... the Ethiopians are keeping the border safe, but not wanting to keep order in Somalia itself because it's expensive and difficult, and the Ethiopians say that no one appreciates what they've been doing for Africa. But this is an African problem, and Africa has no real way of solving it except through UN assistance. There's now Turkish, British, US, and Kenyan, as I mentioned, assistance in a major way in this area. But the Africans are doing the hard work. Now, next door is the South Sudan. You've read about that in the news recently. The South Sudan was created only 3 years ago. It's cut itself off, separated from the Sudan because of Christian-Muslim split, because of long years of animosity between slave raiders, Muslims, and Christians who were enslaved, and later animosity between the two groups. The South Sudan has oil. It has to ship it through Sudan. That's a complication. It'll be years before a pipeline is built from South Sudan to Lamu. The problems in South Sudan that are going on right now are between Dinka and Nuer, for the most part. The Nuer are the smaller ethnic group. It looks like an ethnic animosity, but it's really an animosity between two groups within the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, between the president, Salva Kiir, Dinka, and the former vice president, Riek Machar, who's a Nuer. Riek Machar has worked with the Sudan government, he's worked with the South Sudan government, he's been on this side and that side. He has a PhD in robotic engineering from Bradford University. He's been on every side of all configurations. And what's going right now is a battle for control. It's a battle for power, using ethnic groups as proxies. So the ethnic divide is being used by these two men and the people behind them to engage in a civil war, which has already cost, I think the figure I read this morning was 30,000 lives, and it's going to cause 30,000 more deaths, perhaps, before it's over. It will get over. It will be mediated. The Western powers, particularly the U.S., which helped create South Sudan, don't have patience for the endless war, but it's going to be very difficult in the short term to bring these two sides together, because Riek Machar wants something out of an agreement to call his people off and restore the Nuer to the fealty for the Dinka. So again, this is a power struggle. up next to it in the Sudan proper, this big, large country in Africa, the Sudan proper is war is helping fuel the South Sudan wars by providing aid to the newer under Riek Machar, simply to destabilize the South Sudan. Okay. It also has the wars in Darfur still going on, largely muted, but still happening. It has a war in the Blue Nile province going on. It has another war in South Kordofan. All these wars are to protect the Sudanese government from further secessions. So this is an attempt, as in Putin's Russia, to keep the place together forcibly. Roughly, this is Khartoum, and this is a Blue Nile. This is roughly South Kordofan. So those wars are continuing. Next door to the Sudan is the Central African Republic. It's actually in the center of Africa. It was the Central African Empire. Jean Bedel Bokassa, I mentioned yesterday, the emperor, really caused all the troubles that are happening now. And the Central African Republic is, in the newspapers, is typecast as a Muslim-Christian battle, but it's really, again, a battle between, battle over resources between people controlling the diamonds in the north and controlling the elephant poaching, and people in the south who really have been oppressing the northerners. The northerners invaded Bangui in 2012 and have been in power for a year. They've now been pushed out by the French and the Chadians, and that war will probably simmer down, but there were 80,000 people killed in a small town in the northwest part of the Central African Republic, and there are probably more atrocities we don't know anything about. So that war will slow down thanks to the French intervention. The French intervened in Mali, a war that's still smoldering. There's a minor war going on in Senegal between a part of the southern part of Senegal and the rest of Senegal. Guinea-Bissau, roughly here, is a place of drug smuggling, the center of drug smuggling in Africa, with large conflict over who controls the drug profits. And that brings us to two final points. One is what I was asked yesterday after the talk. What about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb? What about Islamic fundamentalism? Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb operates here. They are a potent force in the shifting sands between Algeria and Mali, between Algeria and Niger. They were fueled by Libyan arms after the end of Gaddafi's rule. They are supported by Al-Qaeda there, an Al-Qaeda franchise, if you like, but they're not getting all their burger recipes as McDonald's might do. They're getting general instructions, and they're operating on their own. And these, in the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, one section of it is led by a former alcoholic who went straight and created a money-making franchise, which is Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. The Mali war, I may have mentioned this yesterday, was fueled by drugs. The first Mali coup. So all these things are resource related or power related. Islam is less potent south of this area, it's not going to be a major factor, and Al-Qaeda doesn't have much chance of putting down roots in most of Africa because of the lack of real Arabic speaking or Arabic ties, the lack of the kind of Islam which would lend itself to jihad. This isn't going to happen much farther south than Nigeria, if even that far north. I want to say a word about Nigeria, because Nigeria has three or four wars going on at any one time. There's a battle for the Niger Delta, which is a battle over oil, a battle in the northeast between Boko Haram, which the word means we want no education, which is a fundamentalist group trying to express itself in that area, again, power-related rather than ethnic-related. And then there are wars, civil wars, in a series of towns over controls over those towns, over the who's going to benefit from the wealth in these towns. Potentially, there could be civil war in Madagascar before too long. There could be some civil conflict in Zimbabwe when Mugabe goes after his 90th birthday next month. And there could be all kinds of things, but those are the countries where the conflicts are. They're number eight. The rest of Africa is mostly peaceful. And even if some places I haven't mentioned are badly ruled. Thank you. Let me stop and leave time for a few questions.
Did you mention the DRC?
Oh, well, thank you. I should have. It's down here. I overlooked it. It's hard to overlook. It's, of course, the size of Western Europe, and it has major, major war that we know about in Eastern Congo. Again, those wars are fueled by greed. Very simple greed, desire to get control over coltan, diamonds, gold.
Isn't it survival rather than greed?
No, it's not survival. These are aggressive wars rather than defensive wars. Some have been fueled by Rwanda, some have been bankrolled by Rwanda and Uganda, but they're basically over minerals. They're not ethnic, even though in many cases there are ethnic groups involved. But these are really chancers. These are led for the most part by renegades, who some of whom will be before the International Criminal Court. And Congo is the poorest country, one of the poorest countries in Africa, and the richest country at the same time. More minerals, more potential, and badly governed. And I'll talk about badly governed on Friday. Anybody else? Question? Okay. Thank you for listening, and time to tomorrow. Thank you.
I'm not sure if they
have to.